Yeah, and I think that's what love is. Like, that is the type of things that are.
Who am I that I would push back?
Every March since 1987, Congress and the United States presidents have designated March as Women's History Month. This year, the Crude Life celebrates and honors their accomplishments once again, along with their contributions in history with interviews, stories that center around women's experiences in oil and gas and industry. The Crude Life supports women in industry since day one and will continue to months after this as well. The Crude Life believes women are vital in energy today more than ever. From a female's point of view to intuition to specific skill sets, women are vital in energy. Today's women in industry are not only modern day leaders, but are truly defining history as well. Everyone here at The Crude Life is grateful for all your contributions to industry, to your communities, and to our planet. Today we celebrate Trisha Curtis with Petro Nerds.
Well, all right, my friends, good day to you. Lucky for us today, we get to speak with Trisha Curtis, and she's the president and CEO of Petro Nerds. And now, Trisha, you're based out of Colorado, yes?
I am. I'm based out of Denver.
Very nice. Well, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm very excited to be on the podcast.
Very excited to get to talk with you. I've been checking out your LinkedIn and the Petro Nerds website, and I can only imagine how busy you are with all of the really good content and podcasts up on the Petro Nerds website that right there for everyone to see too. So very excited to get to talk with you a little bit. Would you want to begin with telling everyone how you got and started in the oil and gas industry?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I'm actually a third generation oil and gas. So technically my grandfather was pumped oil wells, mostly around Wyoming. And my dad also pumped oil wells around Wyoming and Southwest Colorado. And I sort of straddled the border of Colorado and Wyoming growing up. And I guess it was sort of in my blood. But then I went to school in Denver at Regis University for my undergrad and did double the politics and economics. And then I went to London School of Economics, and I was always with economics and international relations and politics. I was always really interested in oil because it just didn't fit nicely with supply and demand, and it moved. Prices moved and supply moved. And so I was super fascinated about it and kind of knew I wanted to work into it or work with it, and studied Russia and China and things like that, and was always interested in the oil side. And then got out of grad school and just was sure I wanted to work within energy, and particularly within oil if I could. And it was just a really tough time with a recession, and it was 2010 and very high unemployment, very hard to get a job. So I ended up buying a one-way ticket to DC and cold calling a bunch of energy organizations till I found the nonprofit that I ended up with, which was called the Energy Policy Research Foundation. And that's really where I was very fortunate to learn a ton and cut my teeth on everything. Sort of the U.S. unconventional oil boom was just happening. Everything shale, the Bakken, and the oil sands and pipelines, and sort of was able to really self-teach myself a lot of stuff and figure out that I was good at presenting and speak with a lot of folks. And just it was a huge blessing in terms of being able to just learn an immense amount about the industry and find out that I was extremely passionate about it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I bet you're really good at puzzles, huh?
I don't do a lot of puzzles, but, you know, maybe I should try.
Well, I was just thinking all of the analytics that you'd have to do, you know, leading up to that. So I guess what has been your favorite part of being involved in the oil and gas industry once you got to really get into the door?
Honestly, I would say that puzzle piece or the learning piece is the best. I mean, there's something that a lot of people, I think, you don't appreciate is just the immense amount of information and the complexity of this business. I mean, anything that's a commodity is, you can study it from a lot of different angles, from how it's produced, how it works, who actually uses it, you know, and how that gets to the end use consumer. And then obviously there's, economic angles of pricing and hedging and everything. But oils are really unique, and especially, now because it is so, it's such a politically controversial thing now, and it didn't necessarily used to be. But that's also another, really interesting dynamic about it is that, this is something that's, that was created a long time ago. under the ground and the ability to extract it through technological means. And that piece of the technology is super fascinating. I mean, if I could just go work on completions, I probably would. And actually, you know, did a bit in a part-time job I had with Antus Exploration. And I love the completion side. I love the ability to think about how you actually, you know, pump water and sand down these wells and how this product actually comes out. So that's super fascinating. And the puzzle piece, I guess, of what type of fruit that is and where it goes and how it works. And I think, and then pulling all that way up to the big stuff is, or, you know, the best part is really working closely with clients and really working on the business strategy and figuring out how does this, you know, what's the information that they need to know or you need to know to really make your business hum. And a lot of folks don't necessarily understand that they do need to understand the oil and gas industry, whether it's they're kind of involved in it or sort of, whether they're a service company and they're just sort of chasing rigs or they're looking at, you know, that's the data that they look at as the rigs, is there's an immense value in just having a deeper understanding of how the market works and why which oil operators, you know, why which companies are in certain areas and why they're drilling that area, why they're at those depths, you know, is that area going to be, are they going to continue to be there? And you have to match up a lot of things with that information on the permitting side and the rig side and the activity. And you just kind of have to, it helps when you study it a lot and you know it and you can explain this information back to your clients and tell them this is what's going on. And it's, I think it's for me, I really enjoy I actually enjoy the challenge of being put on the spot and getting really hard questions of, you know, well, why is it like this? And sometimes the best questions are, you know, the ones that are very basic or the most obvious that a lot of people just don't ask. And it's something like, well, you know, how come the Permian had got all the, you know, why did it take the Permian so long to get all the love when the Bakken had it? You know, and actually having to explain that to a client and walk them through that is a really good thought exercise because a lot of us take it for granted. So I, you know, I just enjoy my work immensely, and I'm super fortunate to have been, you know, to able to survive it through this. 2020 was an extremely rough year and went through a lot of changes with my business. So I'm very fortunate for that.
Oh, I can only imagine. How did PetroNerds come to be?
Petroners came to be through, so when my colleague and I were both working at the Energy Policy Research Foundation, and I think my boss had often come in and just called. I mean, I would stay up late and I would be at the office. It was a townhouse in Georgetown in DC, and you know, I would maybe come in at 10 in the morning, but I would often be there till 2 in the morning if we were crashing on a project or something. And I think I was doing a big infrastructure project or paper, and I would just stay up late and be putting sticky notes on the walls and, you know, doing all the stuff and then getting, you know, crafting something awesome and stay up late. And I think he called me, I'd have maps everywhere and stuff too. And he called me a Petro nerd, and the name kind of just stuck of like, We were true Petro nerds. And then really, I think the work was great, but, you know, we were this nonprofit doing economic policy and technical analysis on the industry, which was awesome. But I think, you know, it was my first real job at a college, and I had just sort of tapped out in terms of, you know, how much I could really learn and go. And it was a small organization. So I had had, you know, I had had quite a few job offers during those 5 years I was there and turned them down because I, you know, right or wrong, I really enjoyed the work that I was doing. And I just didn't think I was going to get that flexibility and freedom at a big company. Now, maybe I should have taken that as experience. But I chose to stay, and then I decided to start my own business. And that's you know, a lot of people probably don't appreciate the intensity of it. You know, you see it on LinkedIn and you see people like the digital wildcatters that I do my podcast, you know, they host the podcast. I mean, they post on stuff like that. But, you know, to quit your job and then start a business, I mean, you just have to be wired in a certain way. So I quit my job in December 2015 and then started the business and, you know, went on with it full time in January 2016 and moved out to Denver and wanted to bring it back, you know, wanted it based here closer to where things were actually happening. And that's, you know, that was 2016. And I can say it was not an easy year either in the business because, as you know, I mean, consultants are kind of the first thing to go. So starting your business out in 2016 and then trying to get work, it was a unique time, but it was probably really good from a learning experience and just like pounding the pavement. And I'm one of the type of people that if you put a challenge in front of me, you know, I'm just going to go on and take it. So that was, I can't say it was easy. It was really, really hard. But it was a really great learning experience.
Yeah. It sounds like you've had to overcome quite a bit of adversity to get to the point where you're at now. Do you think that this most recent transition, or these most recent changes, I guess, from 2020, well, actually even since January 20th, with everything that's been going on even in the last couple of months, do you think that this is going to be more difficult than that 2017 trials and tribulations?
I mean, it's interesting because this run-up in prices, I think, is actually probably, people should be a little anxious about it because I think it's a little too rapid, a little too fast. So we're sort of clouded, I think, by a lot of stuff that's happening within D.C. I think the oil industry probably doesn't have a really deep grasp of how serious the legislative stuff is going to be and how intense, really, that, you know, Washington and the White House are on their views of the oil and gas industry, and that it is going to definitely be an uphill battle. And I have been on the record for saying this for a while. It's kind of impossible to listen to how the White House is speaking and what they're saying, and also to read through the executive orders to not come to that conclusion. And it is a little shocking to me that that's not what I'm hearing and feeling from the oil industry itself, is that they're sort of prepared for that. So in that sense, I would say that, you know, hopefully those folks in the industry, listen to the podcast and they, you know, eventually bring me into the boards and talk to them and have a, you know, are willing to sort of listen to a different side of this, of somebody who's, you know, thinking about what could happen and how you sort of assess the risks and how you sort of prepare for that. But I think 2020 was such a unique, it was a black swan event. You couldn't necessarily really predict it. I mean, nobody could have really predicted oil prices going negative, because in fact, CME Group changed the rules the weekend before to allow them to go negative. I mean, so there was a, you know, series of events that came together. And I think that prices actually going negative and then, you know, April and May and how low prices were. And I think that also jarred the industry significantly. So it's something that OPEC and the Middle East are sort of reeled from as well, is that, you know, they had been very adamant and serious in not letting prices go below 50. And now I think they've sort of let them get a little too hot. But that the reason not going below 50 was for the same reasons the operators in the U.S. felt this massive pain, you know, in the spring months of last year, which were just really, really hard. And then the sort of service industry had to deal with that as well, right? So people were saying, well, how come the rigs aren't coming back faster? And how come the frac fleets aren't coming back faster? And a lot of that was simply because you had come from such low points that people were so, I mean, your brain is jarred, your analytical trajectory of how things are going to look. And there was a massive fear that was going on there. And that's something that, you know, I do wish that I was able to work with more folks. I mean, a lot of people you're not paying for analysis. You're not paying for somebody to talk to. But really, it was the time that you should have been working. It was really the time that you should have stayed course and, you know, held your guns. And really, yes, it's scary. And yes, prices crashed. But have they done that before? Yes. And is that the time that you should drill and complete your wells? Maybe not necessarily produce them. It absolutely is. And so it was, you know, that's what the industry does. They sort of duck and cover. But there was folks that we saw, obviously, if you've seen the rig count and you look at who has brought those rig backs, they're pretty tiny companies. You know, there are a lot of small companies, private equity companies, private players in the Permian that brought, you know, one and two rigs back relatively early. And so they were able, you know, to capture those low prices and to go in on it. And I think that's honestly a super smart move. And obviously it looks smart for anybody who's bringing in wells today, you know, at these price levels. And I think that's just something people have to appreciate too, is that massive gyration in oil prices, that, you know, high oil prices are not, they're not the answer. And I think folks need to get very comfortable with realizing that these prices are not the answer for long-term stability.
Yeah, I guess with that being said, based on our current trajectory, what is it that you think our recovery is going to look like?
I mean, this is you're in the recovery to an extent. I mean, this is the recovery. It's just, I don't think people thought the recovery would have this high oil prices. And it's sort of, you know, you still have operators referencing $50 oil in their earnings calls because that's what they're sort of basing everything off of, and then saying that they're going to give everything on top to their shareholders. And that's true to an extent. I don't think it's true to every small operator. So I think you have this sort of everyone just getting used to this and trying to feel the security behind it. But this is, you are in recovery mode. And I think you just have to, I don't think it's not likely that prices are going to correct massively and go below 50 and hit 40 again. I think we really saw that, you know, where price levels, even after prices went negative in April, we sort of came back to this 40 range and we were stuck there. And that was really with, even with all the demand coming off and all the supply coming off, that was sort of where we were landing. And so I think now it's just, we have to be careful that there is about 8 million barrels a day sitting on the sidelines with OPEC plus, and they will have to come back. And I, something that the market missed, I mean, the market's been wanting to trend higher. You know, we have the flip in the market where we have treasury yields going higher, and we have tech stocks and Tesla selling off, and we have this flip into, you know, the cyclicals, and we have this reflation trade, and everybody isn't worried about inflation, and crude oil prices going up are a huge component of that. I mean, in addition to this massive, you know, nearly $2 trillion stimulus bill and higher oil prices, I mean, this is real inflation, and people are seeing it in copper prices and lumber. And when you see oil prices go up that fast, I mean, that's something a consumer feels, and that's inflationary pressure. And I think that's a concern for a lot of economists, but it's a concern for these emerging markets accepting the, you know, trying to buy these barrels. And it's something that OPEC really has to consider, is that, you know, they will quickly be cooling off that demand pull that they were getting. And in this recent OPEC meeting, they actually allowed, which was not publicized. And, you know, the storm that we had in Texas with taking 3 million barrels a day offline, and the refineries, you know, there's still some that are not back up to full speed. That's all helped propel oil prices higher, and I sort of act as the catalyst the last several weeks. And then there was an attack on one of the Saudi facilities, which didn't actually nothing actually happened, but it was an attempted attack. And so all this sort of let prices go a little bit higher, but it seems to me like traders are taking it there. The problem is that these barrels on the sidelines are going to want to come back. And OPEC plus basically did allow Russia an extra couple hundred thousand barrels a day that they'll be bringing online in through April. And then also Kazakhstan, just a little bit. It's not a ton of crude, but we're talking, you know, probably around 300,000 barrels a day. And the reality too is this agreement, this OPEC plus agreement, is very unique in that they've done a decent job in keeping the cohesion together of the group, but it's structured in different ways. And so when you start looking at the actual numbers, they are exporting a decent amount of crude. I mean, the Saudis didn't completely drop their exports by 1 million barrels a day with this cut that they said they did in January. And then they're also, you know, they allow these countries condensate is removed from the crude numbers. So typically they would have had to really focus on natural gas, and they would have had to cut back on natural gas production, because that would have impacted condensate production. And since they haven't had to do that, they've been able to ramp up natural gas production and ramp up condensate production and kind of offset some of the crude losses. And so really, when you're looking at that, the supply has been, you know, not quite as low as some realize, and that's supportive in a way that the demand side has, you know, supported that, and the market has supported it. But I think at these levels, and the reason crude is trading higher, you know, crude price stability is equally as important as the overall absolute level of price for operators. And that's just something that folks really have to take into account. And I, you know, hedging, people are being ripped right now for actually having hedges in place. And hindsight's 2020, it's easy to say that. But if prices drop $10 tomorrow, those hedges are going to look really good. And I think it's super important if you're private equity backed, or, you know, you're trying to have any kind of stability, is hedging plays a really nice role. I mean, you should layer it in, but it's just an important element to this. And no one could quite predict that we were going to be at nearly $70 oil prices at this point, given the state of events and how it's been traded up.
No, of course not. And I've actually read a few things that would suggest that the prices are actually going to keep going up and not stabilize anytime in the near future, at least not through the not until the end of summer. It's a couple of things that I've read, but obviously I'm excited to get your take on this. I guess in my mind I was thinking getting into recovery rather than being into recovery, because in my brain the energy industry had taken such a huge hit towards the end of January that it was kind of like being sent back into a re-recovery, if that makes sense, once everything got shut down, such as the Keystone XL pipeline, which I had noted in one of your podcasts, you'd said you had been working on almost from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. What OPEC has done and these price moves that we've seen, nobody expected actually this past week that OPEC would not bring any barrels back. And so I did think it was kind of cheap of them to not, you know, to that the media did not cover that they allowed Kazakhstan and Russia to increase those barrels. I think they did that probably on purpose. They probably kept Kazakhstan and Russia quiet and wanted them to play that down so that they could just say, hey, we're extending these cuts. And obviously crude surged on that because everybody thought they were going to start bringing some barrels back, whether it was 500,000 yeah. barrels a day or the Saudis were going to bring a million. So that unexpectedness just gives me a lot of caution for it's, you know, in April, they may say we're bringing 500,000 barrels a day. They may say we're bringing a million barrels a day back. So I think that just gives me a lot of caution and not to pause, but to realize that, you know, you just have a lot of pent up barrels sitting there that are ready and willing to come back. And, you know, when India starts getting louder and louder and countries start getting louder about, you know, prices going up and they're in recovery mode, it's going to impact the demand side. So, you know, there is not unlimited demand at certain price decks. And I think that they have, like, it's already impacting the Indian economy. And it's already, you know, if you're following Bloomberg or you're staying up late at night and you're watching this, it's like the GDP trajectories of India are being changed right now because of the price of oil. So there's a sweet spot in which they sort of need to hit. On Keystone XL and the administrative moves, those are, you know, huge. The Keystone XL was largely a very symbolic move and, you know, obviously hadn't even moved forward within the 4 years of the Trump administration after he sort of reapproved that permit. And it didn't take place. So, I mean, whether or not that was going to get built is a whole nother question. It was the most viable of all the, you know, Canadian pipelines to get built. And truthfully, you know, they do still need one major pipeline because it's extremely important and any energy transportation, whether it's crude or you know, propane or NGLs or anything, or natural gas or whether it's electricity, you need redundancy in the system. And it's important to have those pipelines. So the fact that Keystone XL is not going to get built, that's one thing. But if we have the Dakota Access Pipeline gets emptied and then if Line 5, Enbridge Line 5 gets emptied, if any of those happen or, you know, and a different pipeline is emptied, it starts changing the map and of how crude flows within North America. And it has an impact. And, you know, Keystone XL, so that was a symbolic move. But then when you had the order for the suspension of delegated authority by the acting secretary of Interior, order number 3395, it was suspension of delegated authority, basically limited a lot of folks from doing anything, but it included the suspension of permitting on federal land. And then you had the executive order that came out. So that was all day one within hours. And then you had the executive order come out the following week on January 27th, that basically was the executive order on climate change, which did explicitly list basically it wasn't a permanent ban, but it was a ban for as long as they were doing extensive review and studying on federal lands. And so they basically, you know, extended that suspension on federal land. And the White House had clarified many times in their press conferences that they intended that to be permanent. So it's still mind-boggling to me that people are on the fence of understanding where they intended to be. Now, could they change their minds? Yes, possibly they could change their minds. But that's not the direction. And there is nothing that's happened in D.C. that would, from an energy standpoint, from an oil standpoint, that would lead me to believe that they are looking to help out the oil industry in any shape or form.
Yeah, it seems like that's not really their goal, though, right? Because all of these changes came about with the specific goal of combating climate change is the way that I had understood it. Do you think that they're going to be getting to their goal with this method? Do you think that this is going to help?
No, I don't. I mean, it's absolutely not. So they're using climate change as a reasoning for doing this. And I'm troubled by that because if it's, then we're talking about CO2 emissions. So it should be about CO2 emissions. And I put this article on LinkedIn and I've quoted a few times because, you know, The Economist wrote, it's not a bias or really unbiased article either. It's an article explaining, you know, Biden's climate change agenda. But it very clearly points out that one of the first way of tackling climate change is to go after oil and gas production. And so if you're going after oil and gas production to tackle climate change, and you're going after the emissions from the industry only contribute 1% of CO2 emissions. So that's not, you're unfairly attacking that industry. Now, clearly that's symbolic, right? It's they're producing the oil and gas. But the problem is we have countries all over the world, including Australia and Norway and Canada, who are wholeheartedly have climate change agendas, are part of the Paris Climate Accords, and yet they produce oil. And I don't know if all those are part of the Paris Climate Accords, but they produce oil and gas, and they are not, you know, taking a back seat in that stance. They're not reducing their production or hampering it. And so it's really interesting to me that even the most aggressive and most liberal countries in Europe have not done what, you know, have not tried to do what this administration is trying to do. And so it is absolutely a biased and unfair thing to attack oil and gas production on the basis of emissions. And it just means that you're going to be importing, you know, I think it's probably the opponents or folks on the other side of this probably get tired of hearing it, but it's very true. I mean, if you're not producing it here in the U.S., you are importing it, unless you're substantially reducing your demand. And there's nothing in those executive orders other than trying to push through a massive amount of EVs, electric vehicle uptake, which is a whole nother issue on outsourcing energy security. But we, part of these executive orders and part of the stimulus package that's actually, you know, pushed all this inflation is, you know, everybody's going crazy about electric vehicles and the components. And we are going to see a huge boom in mining, not just, I mean, all over the world. I doubt it will really happen in the U.S. to a large extent because of the environmental stringencies in the U.S. But mining for cobalt and mining for nickel and mining for all the battery components,
lithium,
and earth metal,
yeah,
and lithium. And lithium is one thing. I mean, we've kind of been mining for a long time, but cobalt is a huge component as well. So not just battery components, but stuff that, you know, it's batteries and it's solar panels and it's wind turbines and it's all the stuff that goes into it. And so it's a huge, that in itself, just that impetus and that demand is creating massive inflationary pressure. And so the cost components of that are going to go up, and almost none of those are made in the U.S. So, and it's just important to realize is that, you know, we can build all the charging stations and everything that we want. And that's not necessarily a bad thing for an infrastructure boom and for jobs and everything. But you're not sourcing, if you're not sourcing those batteries and stuff, you're sourcing elsewhere. And, you know, so it's a real thing for energy security. It's stuff that, you know, the thinkers on this stuff from a policy perspective need to be thinking about is that, you know, and China has done a really good job of sort of positioning themselves to be the maker of these products and to be exporting them. And so we'll be sort of outsourcing that, but it's not necessarily, none of it's real yet. So this is all very, you know, this is talk, these are in executive orders. And so it's very theoretical, and yet the market's already moving on it. And so it has just really significant implications, I think, for, you know, the overall economy of how it's going to unfold. It sounds really great on paper. I think it's going to be exceptionally messy. And then another part of this, that climate change executive order, is decarbonizing the grid by 2035, like basically having it a net zero. And a lot of things that people don't think about are carbon capture. And I think you could probably do that with some carbon capture, but if it's being all done through renewables, you know, and I'm not hearing a lot of love on the carbon capture side out of DC, at least, or policymakers. And they're just, again, there hasn't been a whole lot of clarity on this, is that you're going to try to rapidly decarbonize the grid. And, you know, most of us got a little savvy with the grid in this big Texas storm and the subsequent storms thereafter. So if you pull up the grids and you see the actual power source and you look at the U.S., it's, you know, Texas has a lot of natural gas. But because they have that natural gas, they've also been able to have a lot of renewables because the natural gas sort of helps offset that in a time situations. And the rest of the U.S. is still predominantly coal. And so to decarbonize the grid that rapidly is going to have some very fast and jarring implications. And just all these things impact, you know, people's jobs and livelihoods and the economy. And this is not something, this is new. I mean, I've been listening to a bunch of podcasts and doing research on India. And, you know, they have such a huge coal base of people that work and live in coal. And so the, you know, when they're thinking about how to get off coal and to just change up the grid, it's extremely complex, not just because it's entrenched within their economy and their culture and their communities. It's just that it's something that they use and consume, and there's no easy way to just turn on, you know, to flip it. And it's no different than here. It's a big, you know, country with a lot of, you know, these separate states. And I think we often look to Europe and think of how it's been done there. And you know, it's been done in some ways, but I mean, Germany still has, still consumes coal because they have a very strong constituency that produces coal in part of their country, and they have never been able to get rid of that, and they still produce it. I mean, the UK is actually opening a deep sea coal mine for the first time in years, a new one that's not publicized and not talked about, but it's because they're, I think it's actually, it's offshore and it's not going to power, but it is going to steel. And it's just kind of fascinating to me that the UK is going ahead with a new power, you know, a new coal plant when, you know, in the US we're, you know, we're attacking oil and gas production. And it just, this stuff has happened in history before. And it, you know, when you flip this hard one direction, you typically have to flip back another direction. And I don't think these things are going to come out nice and cleanly in reality.
No, it sounds like we might be looking at a little bit of turbulence. Kind of also sounds like even with these executive orders, we still don't really know exactly what's going to end up happening once the implementation occurs because of different varying issues that maybe haven't been thought of. Although I did see that Senator Manchin had come out in support of the coal part of our energy industry, and it sounds kind of like you had mentioned the carbon capturing or the carbon sequestration. It kind of sounds like in places like Wyoming and North Dakota that they're kind of going to be focusing more so on the carbon capturing through coal or with coal. It was pretty fascinating. I've heard tidbits. But obviously, I'm no professional.
No, and you know, it's something that's the thing is, like, you know, I've been in this industry for years, and so people have, you know, what is old always becomes new again, and what people say is like, that's impossible. Nothing's impossible from a technological standpoint, you know. And so people said 5 years ago that carbon capture is dead. I mean, I heard people, very smart people that have done work on carbon capture ever, saying this is completely dead. It will never get off the ground. It hasn't been invested in it. It's not technologically viable. It's not cost effective. Well, you know, when you put a bunch of executive orders and you underwrite this stuff and you have money flowing to it, all of a sudden it becomes really interesting again. And it's basically to get to the emission targets that anybody wants to in the world, whether it's 2 degrees or whether it's 1.5 or whatever it is, you have to have carbon capture in there. It's impossible. You will not hit it. Frankly, you're not going to hit it unless you address India and China. And we're not going to hit it. We're not even going to get close to it by just doing what we're doing in the U.S. So, you know, all our efforts really need to be probably abroad, but that's not politically palatable, and nobody wants to talk or say that. So we just focus everything on here. And it's ways to drive different infrastructure and investment. But carbon capture in itself is, I mean, it makes a lot of sense because you can, but it is really expensive and it hasn't been done at scale. And in theory, you could be doing it off power plants, and you could be, what they're doing in the Permian and what Occidental and Vicky Holub are promoting and have been promoting for years is the using CO2, you know, obviously they're re-injecting CO2 for enhanced oil recovery. And then they're basically making those barrels zero, you know, a zero carbon barrel. It's that because they're capturing all the carbon that's in the production cycle of that. So that they actually teamed up with United, and United is getting barrels from them that have a zero carbon because United is trying to lower their carbon footprint. But, you know, and I'm not saying the efforts of all this, but you do have to ask yourself, what are the costs of all these things? And do they actually, technically, over the life cycle of everything, are they actually lowering the footprint? Because I don't know exactly how all that's being measured. But, you know, if we're talking about a Tesla vehicle, you know, if you're actually, you know, looking at the life cycle emissions of how you made that vehicle, if it's not less on a carbon footprint standpoint, and then if I'm plugging into my house, you know, and I have 33% coal in my house, and that's the power, then it doesn't actually have a lower carbon footprint. Right. So if it's a pure electric grid or something, or if I'm, you know, if I have a battery and it's being powered by the sun, that's different. But I mean, doing all this stuff, and it's just, it's not something that I'm ixnaying or poo-pooing it, is that it's just, you know, renewables do have a place, and you know, technology is awesome, and I love it in the oil and gas sector, but you have to be conscious of what's actually happening. It's no different than saying if, you know, the industry is doing something wrong, is calling them out on it, and then doing a better job. And the industry can do a lot better job in terms of addressing emissions and dealing with that stuff. And I think they are. I mean, the impetus on the industry is doing this. But I think that the fairness is that you need to say, okay, we're going to regulate you. Here's the regulations, and then I'll go comply with them. This industry will do that. They're extremely innovative, and they will rise to the challenge. But putting out, you know, legislation that is that is undeterminable and it has yet to be implemented and putting all these question marks out, it's very hard to navigate and do business. The basics of anything of doing business, you have to have stability and predictability. And executive orders that are written like this do not create stability and predictability. And frankly, they create, they're already creating chaos and wreaking havoc on the market of this, you know, electric vehicle boom and everybody going crazy because they think this is going to be awesome. And the same thing, you can read it for offshore wind, is that everybody's going bananas about offshore wind. There's only a few places in the US where offshore wind technically works and where you actually have the wind and you can do it. And it still hasn't, you know, to have that offshore wind, you have to have very reliable and stable large cycle combined, you know, combined natural gas facilities on the power side. And in the Northeast to basically accept that wind. And I, you know, a little certain we may not have those, or I'm not certain we're ever going to build a new one. If we're so anti-fossil fuels, will we ever build a new? Are we going to continue to use our existing? And we have a lot of natural gas combined cycle facilities and power, but are we going to continue to use them efficiently? And just because we have them doesn't mean that everything's in the right location, you know. And right. I think, you know, knowing where natural gas is produced and knowing where the pipelines are, and, you know, if you are burdensome on the regulatory environment or you can never build a new pipeline, you can impact that production, you can impact that stability and predictability or the economics of things. And that's all really important for, you know, natural gas is going to be a critical component of the uptake of these renewables on the grid side.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, no, it's a... I totally lost a whole bunch of my thoughts and I've been writing down and taking notes. You've got so much information. I could probably sit here and listen to it for hours because this is you have a very unique perspective on what is happening simply because you get to work with all of this information on a daily basis. So that's a lot of things for, I hope somebody is listening. Someone else is listening in the industry too, so that maybe there'll be good stuff coming from it. Because yeah, it kind of sounds like maybe the focus should be a little bit different in order to take a real sustainable approach to making a positive change on this. But I guess until then, like you said, we'll just have to continue focusing on what we're able to do here.
Yep. I think it's a lot of studying and learning, and I appreciate those. Those are kind words, and I did ramble on for a long time. So people probably have to play this back on slow speed. But it's what, you know, fortunately, I love what I do. And so studying it, and I think that, you know, there's a lot of ways you can look at this pretty negatively, but I think there's a lot of ways to study it and sort of work around it, you know, and it does create a lot of opportunity and there are ways to navigate this. So just that, you know, you have to be smart and you have to have your ear to the ground and you have to be, you know, willing to sort of bust your ass and make it work.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's true of anything, but it's right now in the industry, I can't imagine that it's going to get any easier for a moment. So yeah, busting butt and keeping up, keeping that motivation and perseverance, I think is going to be the real key. Actually, on that note, because like I said, I know you're probably pretty busy, but is there anything exciting coming up with Petro Nerds?
You know, I've done a lot in the past, you know, sort of revamping over last fall. The PetroNerds.com has a new website and a new logo. So if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's a small company, but definitely punch up our weight. And I'm speaking at the, or already spoken, it's recorded, but Digital Wildcatters has an Evolve conference that's on the 10th. And so I did a recording and with Chip Molinar, I'm going to get his name wrong. He's the head of Law IQ, or now called Arbo. And so we talked a lot about DAPL and the next evolution of oil and gas transportation. So actually a lot of this stuff, we really get in the weeds on the DAPL and Enbridge Line 5 stuff, which was a great conversation. And yeah, expect big things from Petronerds this year. I'm off to the races and I, you know, really enjoying the podcast, and I want to get some heavy hitters, actually, you know, talk with some CEOs and get involved in stuff. And I probably need to spend a little more time in Houston and doing stuff. And I've actually really enjoyed since I've started the podcast, I've been invited on a lot of other people's podcasts, which has been super fun. So I really appreciate you taking the time and chatting with me. I love the business and I love talking about this stuff, and I love helping people and I love educating. So expect more of that, I guess.
I'm excited to hear that then. Yeah, absolutely. You are extraordinarily knowledgeable. So no, it was a joy listening to what you had to say. And if there's any, you know, big updates or anything that you would like shared, you feel free to let me know. And I would love to get that word out there too. So anyone listening, if you haven't been to the Petro Nerds website, make sure sure you get up there. It is a really cool looking website. You did a great job on the design too. So
thank you. Yeah. So the website, so you can follow me on LinkedIn because I do post a lot of stuff on LinkedIn. Great way to get in touch with me. And then I'm on Twitter as Trisha J Coffee as well. A lot of late night posts on OPEC stuff. So, I mean, you can follow me on there, but feel free to, you know, reach out to me in any of those forms.
Nice. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Trisha. I really appreciate you taking the time with me today.
No, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Anytime.
Sounds great. I'll hold you to it, and hopefully we'll get to talk again then.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, bye.
All right, my friends, that was Trisha Curtis, the CEO and president of PetroNerds. Make sure to go and check out petronerds.com if you haven't already. There's great content up there. It's a good-looking website, highly knowledgeable in the industry, obviously, as you just heard. And if you do like the content you just heard, there's more to find on thecrudelife.com, so make sure to check that out as well. Because you remind me that you're running the show. You're running my show, man, is the type, man, why I'm sleeping alone. Losing my focus and what I love, and you want something they don't even notice. I just want you to know it's more than emotion. And I bet my pride that you are where my heart would rest at home in another life. But in the meantime, that I can't forget. It's short fibers are turning tight, your fibers are burning bright.
Gentlemen, let's give it up for Elma Cook.